Hello and welcome to Talk Fertility, a show where we do just that, talk about fertility. I'm Natalie Silverman, host of the Fertility Podcast, which I launched in 2015, once successfully pregnant after having fertility treatment.
And I'm Kate Davis, a trained fertility nurse and founder of Your Fertility Journey, where I work one-to-one with women and couples to help them understand and optimise their fertility.
So a slightly unusual episode of Talk Fertility for you today. This is a conversation that I had last week whilst hosting a talk as part of a diversity and inclusion festival for the insurance business. Now, the talk was called Fertility in the Workplace, and it was all based on a piece of research that Fertility Network UK had conducted in 2016, where they'd spoken to just under 1,000 people about their experiences of fertility treatment and predominantly the impact it had had on their lives and their work. Now, over 50% of people had no idea about there being an IVF policy in place. And one of the things that I was doing in my talk was explaining what's involved with fertility treatment, the need for there to be flexibility because you have to have multiple appointments, the fact that you might have to go last minute because of how you've reacted to the drugs, the fact that you probably need to inject during the day. So as you will hear in the conversation that you're about to have, you need to put your needles somewhere. The fact that it is massively overwhelming going through treatment whilst trying to maintain your job. And what I did as part of this talk was explain all the different things that employers and HR people and managers all need to be aware of, in the hope that we can normalize this conversation more when it comes to if you're going through treatment at work or if you are an employer and this might be something on your radar. Normally, a woman will need, say, 6 to 8 to 10 days off for fertility treatment, and this shouldn't have to be taken as annual leave or sick pay. And this shouldn't have to be taken as annual leave. If there is a policy in place, then it just takes away the stress and prevents women from quitting work, which a lot of women do, or as you'll hear in this upcoming conversation, stepping back. So you're going to hear a conversation I had with one of the panel members, a lady called Sheila Cameron, and here Sheila is now to explain. Kate wasn't there with me, so she's not part of this interview, but we both felt it was a really important conversation to share with you. And Kate and I will be back with you next week. Be sure to listen to the end for details again of how you can get in touch with us, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, I'm Sheila Cameron. I'm the Chief Executive of the Lloyd's Market Association. In late 2008, my mum got diagnosed with terminal cancer, and at that point I wanted to speed up the journey to having children so that my mum could meet grandchildren before she passed away. And on that route, she was diagnosed in November 08, and we started pretty much straight after that going through all the tests, and I had a running joke of dropping my pants for half the doctors in London trying to figure out what was wrong and what might be the cause of our infertility. And we ended up with the unexplained diagnosis, which I think was one of the most frustrating things to be diagnosed with. Because for me, it was a case of, I'm not the unexplained person here. The unexplained is you, medical community, because you haven't done the right test yet, or you haven't come up with the right test yet. So I felt the blame was being put on me, so to speak, and it just didn't feel right or fair. And it just was so frustrating to not know how to go forward, to know that we were going to spend all of this money on treatments, and it was, you know, black or red, which one shall we go with? It felt like an absolute gamble because we didn't know what the problem was that we were trying to solve. We were just going to throw everything at it.
And at that point of being diagnosed, you weren't eligible for any funding, so it was pretty much, there's a problem, but you're going to have to go and self-fund.
So what happened was we went under NHS initially and went to one hospital in London, and we had an IUI treatment through that hospital. And they said to us, don't worry about it, you know, if you just pay for the IUI, then you'll still be eligible for IVF treatment to be funded by NHS in your local area. And it turned out we were given the wrong advice. So the fact that we had had one IUI that we had paid for meant we couldn't get any NHS funding at all to go forward, because the policy of our local NHS authority was one treatment, and if it's done at an NHS hospital, that's it. So we lost out on both sides, both having it done at an NHS hospital, thinking it was, if we did it privately through them, it would be fine. But then we lost our NHS treatment as well, which was really frustrating.
So you know you've got to start working out where to go and what to do, and you're in a senior level position. From the outset, were you adamant that you weren't going to say anything at work? It was just, there was no discussion. It was just something that you just went and got on with.
It was not up for discussion as far as I was concerned. I was afraid of how I would be perceived once I admitted to the treatment that I was going through, that I would be overlooked for any potential promotion that might come up, that I would get the ear on the shoulder, people looking at you sympathetically, you know, trying to be empathetic. And I found this subsequent to the birth of my son. There was a lot of benevolent sexism type of thing going on of, well, you won't want to do that because, you know, you've just had a new baby, or you won't want to do that because, and I felt if I told people what we were doing, they would take opportunities away from me. Now, as it happened, I started to step back from those opportunities anyway, because the journey became quite difficult and quite trying and quite emotionally exhausting. So in an effort to protect myself, I started stepping back. I took easier roles. I took roles that were less demanding from a travel perspective. I stepped back, and I really wish I hadn't.
At that time, you had told friends and family about it, though, so you weren't entirely closed with what was happening. So there was some element of support was there. Did you have any peers that had gone through it?
So there was some element of support in terms of my family that I told, and a few immediate friends, but I didn't know anybody personally who was going through it. I suspect afterwards, because I didn't tell them, they didn't talk, we didn't know we were going through it at the same time. So I think that was part of it. But the support that I had from immediate family and friends was great. You know, my sister, my brother, my dad, they were all incredibly supportive and helpful through the journey. But I didn't tell anybody at work, nobody at all. And, you know, when it came to, you know, some subsequent experiences where I had problems at work, pregnancy related problems, it was a real problem that I hadn't told people that of the journey that I was on. Simple things like I had to inject Clexane. It was twice a day I had to inject Clexane, and I had nowhere to put the needles because there wasn't anywhere in the office that you could safely dispose of them. So I ended up carrying in one of those little yellow boxes in my handbag so that I could safely dispose them. And if I forgot the box, I then had to wrap the needle up in tissues. And eventually I got to the stage where I realised you could get those needles where it withdrew back into the syringe, or a cover came down over the needle, one or the other. And that just made simple things like that easier. But it's you're hiding this, and it becomes so complex. Right down to, you know, well, I need to take the injection at this time, or, you know, I need to insert this pessary at this time. And you're stuck in an all-day meeting, and you're determined by the timetable of that meeting rather than what you need to do, which is a real challenge, as you're hiding it. And it's, you know, it's hard enough to hide it, and then you have got to hide all these other bits that go with it, which makes it a real challenge.
And whilst you're going through this and you're navigating your way through a top level job and you're dealing with that stress, you've got your mother who's terminally ill, do you feel that you stopped and thought about your own mental health and your own well-being in terms of everything you were taking on? Obviously there's things that you're having to prepare yourself for the inevitable to a part, but then there's a kind of bittersweet because you're hoping that you're going to get pregnant as well as having to deal with what ultimately was a bereavement.
Yeah, I didn't plan for it at all. I didn't think it through. I thought I was a really strong, resilient woman. I don't need that help. I'm fine. And how foolish was I? So after my mother was diagnosed, I dropped down at work to do 9 days every fortnight. So every second Friday, I would fly back. Every second Thursday night, I would fly back to Dublin. And I'd spend that weekend with my family and with my mum. And I thought I was fine because I had dropped back down. But actually, every weekend I used to go home the rest of my family would scatter because they're like, right, Sheila's home, she'll take care of mum this weekend and we can have some time off. So I was going hell for leather at work. I was hiding all sorts of stuff at work about my treatment. Then I would go every second weekend back to see my mum. And, you know, and then I was taking care of her 100% almost on my own during those weekends. So it was a real challenge. And it's only looking back now in hindsight that I think, what the heck was I doing? How could I possibly have thought that my mental health would be okay through that? And what subsequently happened after the birth of our first child was I ended up crashing into postnatal depression. And that's the only way I can describe it. I absolutely crashed into it because it was the first time I stopped. It was the first time I stopped my mum had been diagnosed 18 months before she died, or 19 months before she died. And it was the first time that I stopped to go, okay, right, now I've done everything. I've had the child. My mum has passed away. And my brain just went, okay. And, you know, it just collapsed. And I didn't realise at the time, actually, that there is a huge risk associated with IVF and postnatal depression. So I've discovered afterwards through my GP that actually there's a couple of... I was a postnatal depression waiting to happen. I'd had a significant bereavement. I'd had a birth trauma because I'd had 48 hours in labour and then ended up with an emergency section. I'd had IVF treatment. I'd had a boy, which I hadn't realised was actually quite a significant factor in getting postnatal depression. So I think it's something we need to talk a bit more about in IVF circles around the risk associated with that, because I did not take care of my mental health going through the journey at all, and it came back to haunt me when my son was born. It was a really rough journey, and I, in hindsight, when on subsequent journeys, I made sure I went and I spoke to a counsellor all the way through. Before our first pregnancy, I didn't speak to any counsellor. I'm strong enough, I'm good enough, it'll be fine, I know what I'm doing. And that was a big mistake. I really, really wish I hadn't done that. I really wish I'd prepared myself more for it. And certainly when we went on to have our second pregnancy, I made absolutely sure I went and took care of my mental health through the entire process. So I spoke to a counsellor all the way through the second round of treatment. I spoke to them all the way then through my pregnancy, and again straight afterwards. So I think 3 or 4 days after coming out of the hospital, my first time away from the twins that we had at the second pregnancy, was to go and see the counsellor. And it was... to this day, I think it's the best thing I ever did was meet with that counsellor and take care of my own mental health.
And how did you find out about them?
So I remember going to my GP, and my GP was great. She diagnosed it fairly quickly. And she said, I'm not sure if it's delayed grief or if it's truly postnatal depression or what it is. And she said, it doesn't matter. We need to get you help. And she said, but there's none on the NHS. So here's a website, go look that up and see if you can find a counsellor that way. And I remember being horrified, thinking, what? Mm. You know, I'm in a fortunate position where I can afford to pay for this privately. And we did manage to find somebody. It was actually, the way we found it was I was going to a cranial sacral therapy for my son. The lady there said, actually, I know some therapists, I'll help you out, I'll find you one. That's how we found a local charity that helped women with postnatal health in particular. So that lady helped me then for the next 2 or 3 years overcome, you know, a number of issues, both in terms of dealing with the grief from my mother's passing, but also dealing with the enormous frustration, disappointment, highs and lows that is the IVF journey.
So she wasn't necessarily infertility trained, but she understood and could.
She understood it, and she didn't want to put a label on it. She was just, you know, there are so many bumps and lumps that come with mental health after when you become a mother for the first time, and we really need to talk about that more. But she had had experience of dealing with other mothers who had had postnatal depression and had been through the IVF journey. And she listened to me rant and rave a lot about how unexplained infertility is just such a horrible label.
Yeah.
And listen to my rant every now and again. But she helped also help prepare me for whether I wanted to go back on the, I used to term it the IVF treadmill again.
Yeah.
And she helped me think that through and helped me think about what that was going to do to my life and whether I was ready to go on that journey or not. So it was absolutely worthwhile, and I'd strongly encourage anybody to go make sure you take care of your mental health just as much as your physical health when you're on the IVF journey.
Because some of the conversations I've had with clinics is that they have an approach where from the outset they explain the emotional toll of the treatment, and they almost put in place fertility coaches or counsellors to guide you every step of the journey, which to me sounds, you know, the ideal, and it's something that I hope more clinics start to take on, because you just don't know, and like you said, totally unprepared for what it could be. And then you add in the mix of what you were trying to manage at work, aside from what else was going on in your personal life, it's just too much for anybody. And I know you said that there was some well-being therapy from work. So as far as seeing what's available in the workplace, put yourself back there as to when you sought that out. Was that during your second pregnancy, or was that...
So actually that was during the IVF treatment. So
Before Arthur.
So the place that I worked in had a policy of having a treatment every single day. So that might be a massage therapist would come in on Mondays, an acupuncturist on Tuesdays, or a reflexologist on Wednesdays. And I was of the view, do you know what? I have no idea if these work or not. But it's good for me to just take some downtime. So I would try to do one or two treatments every week, and I particularly used to fall in love with acupuncture and reflexology. And like I said, I've no idea if they worked, if they made a difference, I don't know. But taking downtime and taking time just to chill out and try and empty my head was a really good thing and worthwhile thing to do.
I know from speaking with acupuncturists and reflexologists in this space, and I'll share links to podcasts having those conversations, that there is evidence about the benefits of it. If it was clearly written that this is something for you if you are in the place that you were actually in, would that have been more useful?
I used to talk to the acupuncturist a lot about this, and he was fascinated by me because I was taking my temperature every morning, you know, as part of the treatment, and to know when I was fertile. So he used to give me the herbs to take.
The tea.
Which, yeah, that was awful.
Oh, the tea.
But we could prove that my temperature dropped every time I was on the tea. So does it work? Is there a scientific link? Absolutely, there is a scientific link there. There was a part of me, though, that was also going with my more corporate head on, going, yes, but it's not backed up enough. And, I want to see this listed on the NHS and all the rest of it. And eventually I just got over myself and went, do you know what, this is crazy. If it works for me and I can prove it, and do you know what, if the worst that happens is I stop for half an hour every day, great. That's fantastic, and I know that's to my benefit. And actually we can prove it. Certainly with the acupuncture we were able to prove it, that it was having an effect on my body, which is what we wanted it to do.
So staying in the workplace, you talked about stepping back from challenging roles. There's a significant moment in all that you were going through that you describe as you losing your shit in the office. Run through that for me, because I think that was quite a wake up for yourself, wasn't it, when it just leapt out of you?
Yeah, so what happened there was, after we had successfully conceived for the first time and I had the first pregnancy test that was positive, it would appear that getting pregnant is my problem. Staying pregnant was fine, or so I thought. And I still hadn't told anybody in the office about what was going on. And I got to 11 and a half weeks and I was like, oh my goodness, I'm in touching distance. I'm nearly there. I'm nearly at the magic 12 weeks. And I was reading all sorts of stuff that said, oh, you know, well, 10 weeks is the new 12 weeks kind of thing at the time. And thinking, well, am I there? Should I start talking about it yet? And then at 11 and a half weeks, I had a massive bleed. And I just completely, as I said, lost my shit in the office. There was snots and tears everywhere, is the only way to describe it. And I remember the chief actuary happened to be near me at work, and she took me into her office. And she's like, Sheila, what the hell is going on? What's going on? And through the snots and tears, I eventually told her. And she got my boss, who was the CFO at the time, and he came in as well. And they're like, right, we're just going to get you in a cab. We're going to call your husband for you. We're going to get him over here. We'll get you in a cab. We'll get you home. What else can we do? What else can we do? And I wrote to him later that day and said, look, this is the full story. You need to understand why I broke down the way I did today, because it has taken us years to get to this point. And I was just at that touching distance, and I think I've lost the one thing that I have been trying so hard for. And he was amazing. He was incredibly supportive, and you know, I don't want to see you in the office for at least another week. Just take your time, do whatever you need to do. You know, if there's anything we can help with, let us know. Then the next day, I managed to get a scan, and it proved that the heartbeat was still there, so Arthur survived. And then we had another scan, then the typical 12-week scan, and that's when we came out and started telling people more publicly. But my greatest regret was not telling work before then. When it hit the fan, they were so supportive, and they could not have been kinder, they could not have been gentler with me, they could not have been more supportive. So big regret for me, and lesson learned of, you know, trust the people around you. They're good people.
Now, part of the conversation we're trying to create and normalise is the importance of there being some kind of IVF policy in the workplace, and you said that there wasn't anything policy-wise.
No, there wasn't anything at this time in terms of IVF treatment or any policy related to infertility or fertility itself. So, which was a real shame. But it's a debate that we need to have, and it's a debate we need to open up about. You know, the simple things. The example I gave of I had nowhere to put my needles. Mm. You know, from the injections I was taking. That's the sort of thing that's really, really simple to overcome. I had nobody to talk to about it, and I didn't know. I remember the HR manager at the time was pregnant at the exact same time as me, but she hadn't gone through any of the IVF side of things. And trying to explain it to her then subsequently, she's like, oh my goodness, we had no idea. We had no idea that this is what you needed in place. And, you know, I understand that the NHS have a policy in some of their trusts which say they will give, I think it's about 10 days per year for it to be used flexibly by those undergoing the treatment as they see fit. And I think that's a great start. I know if anybody came to me in our office and said, I'm about to go on the IVF journey, what do you think? My first response would be, well, first of all, get a clinic near you. So I was incredibly lucky that I found a clinic that was about 100 metres, that had a scanning and bloods drawing place about 100 metres from our office. So that made life just logistically so much easier. But the other piece of advice I'd give if anybody was coming in is just take the time you need. It's absolutely fine. You know, you and I have had a conversation about somebody else and how she saw and a number of people who are having treatments at the same time as her, and they stepped back and they actually left their jobs because they felt they needed to do that to cope with the treatments that they were going through. And that, as an employer, that's such a shame. You've invested so much time, effort, money in getting these people up to the level that they're at, in making them ambassadors for your organisation, and we need to keep those people. Those women are doing fantastic work. And if it's all for the case of just give them some flexibility to help them on their journey, let's just do that. And let's, you know, let's open up the conversation and let's make it normal to talk about this.
Because you spoke about one of the reasons that you weren't speaking out about it was because you felt it wasn't a welcome problem. And that language is almost part of the problem, that we think that we are a problem. And you use words like being embarrassed and ashamed. How can we help the conversation in the corporate space with women who are embarking on this journey or have been trying and have just started to have some tests, feel that? Because first of all, the shame and the guilt is something that men and women have to overcome when they can't conceive naturally. Nobody wants to walk through a clinic door, and it's become less taboo. In the time I've been making the podcast, the conversations have become more free. There's more places online that people are talking about it. Yet in the day-to-day work space, it's either someone knows someone who's had IVF and they say the wrong thing, or it's the opposite and nothing can be said. So How do you feel we can encourage the conversation?
So I think for women in the corporate world, they like to see role models, typically, and they need to see role models. And I think a huge obligation on people like me and others is to speak up about our experiences and make sure that, you know, seeing somebody quite senior in their industry talking about it makes a difference. You know, then you can see what you want to be, and that makes such a difference to people. I know that if I had known of three or four other people in my company or in my industry who'd been through it, and I could ring them up and go, oh, can we go have a coffee? Can you talk me through your experience and give me any advice that you had? That's where we need to start, is just any of us who have been through this treatment need to start talking about it, because we know how difficult it is at the beginning of that journey, how frightened you feel, how frightened for the treatment you're about to go on, the amount of money you're about to spend, the perception that your workplace might have or your manager might have. We all know what that feels like. So let's normalise the conversation and let's try to be role models and talk about it. So, you know, I think if anybody who has been through this treatment and come out the other side, either with a child or without a child or whatever experience they've had, we should talk about it and we should get out there and make sure people hear our story. Let's normalise the conversation.
One point that you made to me, which I thought was really vital as well to stress again, was about not being afraid to focus on your career in all of this. Just want to reiterate that.
Yeah, so for me, when I, as I said, I dropped down to 9 days a week, I dropped back to easier roles. And I really wish I hadn't done that, because I was perfectly capable of doing those roles. Now, I should have been looking out more after my mental health, which is a slightly separate issue. But I would have been perfectly capable of going after those roles and executing those roles really, really well. And I feel I stepped sideways off my career path for a few years just to take easier roles. And I know I went in and I said, okay, I want that role over there. And my boss saying, are you sure? Are you sure that's the way you want to go? And me going, yeah, that's the right role for me right now, you know, because I've just got stuff on, so I think this is the right way to go for now. And he subsequently found out why I did that, but I really wish I hadn't. There was nothing stopping me. I still had a good brain. I still knew how to do stuff corporately, how to get stuff done. But I just chose to step back, and I really wish I hadn't.
And you talked about looking forward, and if there was no baby.
Yeah, what would have happened if there was no baby? You know, then I would have taken 3-4 years out of my life, out of my career, at, you know, in my mid to late 30s. So at a time when it's a critical time for any woman in their career, in terms of that's the point at which you get some of the bigger roles, you're being tested before you can go up the ladder, so to speak. And I stepped back at that point, and that's just not the right time to do it, because where could I have ended up? I could have ended up with no children and a kind of a stubbed career. You know, one that had been hampered because I had chosen to step back, and where would I have been then? So that's why I feel that was a crazy decision for me to take at the time. Now, I think if I had been looking after my own mental health better at that point, I might have made a different set of decisions.
Now, we've just been speaking on a panel together as part of the Dive In Festival. First of all, I want to thank you, because I know that was the first audience that you had spoken in front of. I know you've been speaking out a bit more in the workplace, and you've said every time there's been quite a reaction, or the fact that people now know that it's a journey that you went on, they'll talk to you more about it. How do you feel after that conversation, and what do you hope that these types of diversity and inclusion conversations create? And was there any surprising feedback from anybody in the room?
I feel really proud that I've done it.
Good.
And I feel, you know, a lot of people don't know the story that I'd been through. They didn't know. Some people would have known about that I'd done IVF, but they would not have known about my mother having terminal cancer, you know, how devastating it was for me personally, and still is to this day, that she never got to meet her grandchildren. And most importantly, I've never spoken out about postnatal depression. And even when I do talk about my fertility experience, or infertility experience, I had never really spoken publicly about the postnatal depression side. So that was a big step for me to talk about that today, but I think it's incredibly important. And I think it's incredibly important we talk about this side of infertility and IVF and all that happens with it that people don't seem to be aware of. You know, there are so many risk factors out there for postnatal depression, and going on an IVF journey is another risk factor, and we need to talk about that, and we need to prepare women who are on those journeys to make sure that they know that this is a possible side effect that they could experience.
Because if when you're sat in those early days of consultations and the consultant says, and then there's this, and then there's this, then of course you'd just be like, oh my God. But I guess at least the conversation's there. And like you say, then you could say, okay, I'm going to arm myself with a counsellor, and I'm going to arm myself with Headspace, and I'm going to not necessarily take a lesser role, but I am going to allow myself to have some flexibility in the workplace. Yeah. And you'd just be more prepared, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. I mean, in hindsight, when I remember after Arthur was born and I went to meet my GP, and I was just crying and crying and crying, and she just looked at my notes and she went, oh my goodness, you've got every risk factor except for one, and the one I didn't have was a history of depression. But like, why didn't anybody see this beforehand? You know, why wasn't I told that this might happen? Why wasn't I told that this was a huge risk? And I wouldn't expect to be told it up front. That's okay. But I think once, you know, I'd got through the 12-week mark and I was, you know, looking like I was going to embark on a successful pregnancy, then we should have had that conversation. And, you know, either the consultant I was seeing at the hospital, or my GP, or a midwife.
Were you seeing the same GP and same consultant each time?
I was seeing the same consultant each time because I was high risk. So because of the blood thinners that I was on throughout the pregnancy and for another 3 months afterwards. So I was deemed high risk. And with the second pregnancy with the twins, I was deemed obviously high risk at that point as well. So I had the same consultant both times. I don't think mental health was particularly top of his list. But I know the midwives, when I came second time around when I was pregnant with the twins, was watched a lot more closely second time around, which really helped knowing that safety net was there around me and people were looking out for me. Now, as it happened, I didn't experience any postnatal depression after the twins. I was very lucky not to. But, you know, it's back to, let's just talk about what all these risk factors are. So we all go in with our eyes open, particularly if you find out it's at 20 weeks that it's a boy, and you know you've recently had a major bereavement, and you've been through IVF treatment, and you work at a big job in the city, so you know that tick 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 in terms of risk factors.
I think it's massively kind of powerful to point that out, and it's something that really stuck with me when you first made those points. And I think, like you say, if we can just educate people, and I wonder if with the twins, because you were so much more aware and you'd invested in the counselling and the support, and like you say, you had more support from people along the way, that all those different contributing factors helped you through it.
Absolutely, I think I did. And it helped that I was taking care of my own mental health, and that I had prioritised it even before we got pregnant. So I was talking to my counsellor around, right, well, how will I feel when this happens or if that happens? And then when I found out it was twins, it was like, oh, I need to talk to you now. So, but she was fantastic and an enormous support, and helped me to focus on the right things along the journey.
So if someone's listening and they're working in a corporate environment and this is literally screaming, you know, at them as to things that they need to address, is it HR? Is it manager? What's the first port of call that you would advise in the position that you're in to somebody?
Find somebody else who's been through the journey. There will be, you know, it's 1 in 6. There's probably somebody else on the floor in your, you know, in on the same floor that you work on, if not one or two people who are going through the same journey or have been through it. This is why it's so important for those of us that have come out the other side to talk about it. Because we need to be there and be the role models and the allies for those people who are just starting on this journey. And I really desperately wish I had had somebody at my office back then who I could have just spoken to and gone, oh my word, what's all this about? What do I do? How do I navigate it? And just having somebody to support me if I wanted to go and talk to HR. And I don't think HR would have been at that time, I don't think they knew what to do. They wouldn't have known what to do. But to speak with somebody and say, well, actually, you should go and tell them X or Y or Z, that, you know, you need time off to just pop in and out and do these scans, or, you know, you can do those at lunchtime, or you'll have the blood draws at this time, and that you just need some flexibility. I think also your immediate line manager is really, really important in this journey, because if you have somebody who's an absolute clock watch, who said, right, well, you were 37 minutes and you said you'd only be 30, I mean, that's a real challenge, and that's a... it's really difficult to deal with individuals like that, and in that case you do need somebody like HR. But you can have fantastic, amazing, supportive line managers, like, as it turned out, I had and didn't realise I had, who would just protect you and support you on your journey. So you just need to find those allies, find those role models, find those people like you and me who've been on that journey, who are prepared to stand up for you and advocate for you and to help you on this journey.
Now, as you'll know if you've listened to the show for a little while, is I like to share other episodes from the Fertility Podcast back catalogue. And this Fertility in the Workplace conversation is something that I've had several times, including as part of the Fertility Show, where I host the Let's Talk Fertility stage. Now, it's happening in London from the 1st to the 3rd of November. And on Friday the 1st, we are going to be continuing this conversation about fertility in the workplace. So do come along if it's something you want to hear more about and be able to speak to some experts. This is a conversation I had with a lady called Hortense Thorpe, and she will be at the show talking with me again in November. But here's Hortense sharing her experience of going through treatment at work and what she's done to help other women.
My name's Hortense Thorpe. I'm originally from France, but I've been living in the UK for 12, 13 years. I work for a large utilities company. It's Centrica British Gas. And like, unfortunately, many other people, I have been struggling with fertility. I've been trying to conceive for a number of years and have gone through two IVF cycles so far.
From that kind of initial stage of having to maybe have further investigations as far as what you were trying to find out was going on, were you at that point able to take time out from work, talk to somebody, get support in what you were able to achieve to go off and have tests?
Yeah, and I'm actually really feeling very lucky. It's a privilege to work for my company at the moment because it has really helped me. And that's what I want to talk about to more people, to try and get more organizations to support their employees going through tough situations like these. And so when I started having fertility issues, or recognizing that actually it was not happening and it couldn't happen naturally, obviously there were so many appointments to attend. I even had several surgeries to try and fix things before we even could start IVF. And we do have flexible working, and my type of work, I'm an outsourcing manager. So I work with suppliers. I'm based in an office, but we can work from home. We can work from anywhere. We have lots of tools that can enable us to work from even our phones, you know, and that has really helped, because even though I was going to lots of appointments, missing work time during the day, I could still catch up on my work in more convenient times in the evenings, etc. It's helpful to have flexible working, but the most important thing is your manager. You know how caring and supportive they are, and how they trust that you can still do a good job whilst, you know, sort of missing a few days of work. Or I didn't have to really take days off apart from when I had surgeries, but I didn't really take time off for appointments, for example, because I could catch up on my work later on.
So when you knew you were going to have to go for tests and the surgeries that you described, were you aware that there was a policy in place because it had been spoken about, or did you go and ask and then find out that they were going to be lenient and flexible in what you needed to go off and do?
Well, yeah, actually, you know, I didn't know initially.
Yeah.
It was only by chance that we have a women's network which organizes events regularly. And at one of those events, somebody mentioned that actually we had an IVF leave policy. And so all of a sudden, there was these 5 days of paid leave that I could take every year.
Wow, okay.
For months. Yeah, so and that really sort of, that was quite a relief, because I thought at the time I hadn't started the process yet. I was still going through all the surgeries and the checks. And so when I thought, oh, actually, you know, there's that I can benefit from, that's not too bad. Actually, 5 days is not that much.
Yeah.
I feel bad for saying it, because it's already a great step. 5 days, you can easily take those 5 days within one cycle, depending on, you know, how flexible your work is. I think there can be more than that, though, in the policy.
Well, so you're now working in your company, and also you're working with Fertility Network to make these conversations happen and to educate people. And it's a new initiative that Fertility Network are trying to make happen. You're in this place now where you're still trying to conceive. What's the situation with work, having used up that time? Where do you stand?
I think, obviously, if I do need to take more time off, it'll have to be on my probably my annual leave and things like that.
Right.
I don't feel too stressed about that particularly. I think it's more how you get support throughout that journey, or the quest for fertility, really.
Yeah. Because obviously your work now know that that's what you're trying to achieve, because you've told them. So that stress of telling has kind of gone. Do you feel there's any pressure? Because there has been conversations from people that I've spoken to in the past that by telling their work that this is what they're trying to do, they might feel that they've maybe been pushed out or been less supported, because ultimately it means you're then going to be hopefully going on maternity.
Thankfully, I've not experienced that myself. I do hope that our company is now, you know, open enough to all that and supportive enough, because they recognize, and any organization should recognize, that to get really productive employees, they should get happy employees. And a maternity leave should not be a reason for, you know, to get rid of somebody, because on the contrary, you know, it's probably people that are very dedicated to their jobs, very passionate about it, and they should retain them. And in our company, actually, they do put in place a lot of things to help us stay whenever possible, but also come back and return to work after maternity leave. So there's a good maternity package. There's, you know, there's lots of benefits like that. But the most important thing is how supportive your manager is, and your colleagues as well. So yes, you were saying, you know, some people may feel some pressure, maybe from their peers or from their managers. I think it's really incredible that could happen still nowadays. In our team, in my organization, is on the contrary, you know, I've opened up sort of a can of worms by talking about it, because then you're likely to get questions about it from people, and they don't really sometimes realize that you might not be in a good place to respond to questions about how it went, are you pregnant yet, or things like that, you know. So people have to realize that it's still kind of a difficult subject, but just by caring, by asking people how they are, you know, wherever stage they're at in that journey or that quest, at least knowing that people care for us is really important. And I have seen that more and more now, and colleagues, you know, stop for a minute and ask me, so how are you? And that's all we need to hear, you know, sometimes. So
yeah.
it makes a big difference.
Is that part of the training that you're hoping to help other organizations understand, is that language that's used?
Yeah, so within our organization, we're, for example, starting to prepare a manager toolkit and an employee toolkit to help people understand what it's like to go through, and the things to expect, the things that can help, the things that can hinder, you know, or stress people and improve, even though we've already got some elements in place and people are very caring and we've got flexible working, which helps, but not all jobs are available for flexible working. So it's not always appropriate, but there are definitely other elements that can still help the employees that are in those situations. So manager toolkit, I think, is important for people to know how to handle an employee that is going through that, and what to expect, what are the things that help them, the things that can stress them. And then for the employees is, if there are things like the IVF policy and the paid leave, and know that it's available, but also things like healthcare system, or we have something called MyCare, which is a hotline, and you can call anytime and get counseling, you can get support, so you can speak to somebody.
That's
and I think
amazing.
That's also, yeah, the mental health aspect is just really as important as the rest.
So if you have a question about anything you've heard in this episode, please email talkfertility@gmail.com. As always, you can follow me, Natalie, on my Instagram or Twitter @fertilitypoddy. Kate is @your_fertility_journey on Instagram, or just @fertjourney on Twitter. We always love hearing from you. We love your feedback on the show. And like I say, we'll be both back with you again next week.